the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. I'm pleased to welcome Sharon B. Smith to the show this week. Sharon Smith was the host of Down the Stretch, the weekly show devoted to horse racing that aired in the early days of ESPN, and was one of the most interesting and intelligent shows ever on TV, not only of sports but of any kind. Sharon Smith also added her intelligence to the NBC broadcasts of the Breeders' Cup races, to which the network used to devote the entire day, and to which they now devote an hour. Sharon B. Smith knows all about horses and almost all about everything else, and has written quite a few books. Her latest is The Best There Ever Was, Dan Patch and the Dawn of the American Century. Sharon B. Smith, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
And thank you very much.
The Best There Ever Was, Dan Patch and the Dawn of the American Century. It's a great book, and I want to discuss it with you in a bit. But first, can we talk about your broadcasting career?
Sure.
You were really there at the dawn of cable TV. How did you get involved with ESPN?
Well, I had been a news reporter and anchor for television up to that point. I worked in various places, Texas and New York, and then I came to New Haven, Connecticut, and worked a year at a television station there, just at the time that ESPN was going on the air in Bristol, Connecticut, which is, I think, about 50, 60 miles away. And my station had an exodus of people going up to Bristol, and I was among them. So I went up there and enjoyed the years I spent there very much.
Well, I remember you also hosting Sports Center and everything else. But what about Horse Racing Weekly Down the Stretch? Was that your idea?
Well, you know, it was interesting. In the very early days of ESPN, the network didn't get major sports. The NFL would have been totally impossible, and Major League Baseball and so on. When I was there, the broadcasts were of Australian rules football and yacht racing and a few other things. And after I'd been there about a year, they obtained the rights to a few horse races and basically went into the newsroom and said, anybody here like horse racing? And I waved my hand and said, yes, yes, I love it, I love it. And so that's how I really started covering horse racing. And that evolved into Down the Stretch after we did a few races.
And did you write that show as well?
Yeah, I was the primary writer of the show and laid it out, and there was a producer to pull video, you know, get the pictures from around the country. And it was a very small staff, me and a producer, but we had a great time doing it.
Yeah, well, of course, ESPN now is like a completely different thing, but it was very cool back then. It really seemed like, I don't know, there was a lot of heart in the show.
Well, you know, there hadn't been regular horse racing on television for many, many years. In some local markets, there'd be a weekly show, or even, I don't know if there were daily shows at that point. We're talking about the mid-1980s. But there hadn't been national coverage of horse racing, with the exception, of course, of the Triple Crown races for many years. And the show developed a very devoted following because there were always a lot of horse racing fans, maybe not as many as there were decades ago, but there were still plenty of fans, and they just loved to see horse racing on television.
And then you went over to NBC, or did you continue to be on both?
I just did NBC for specific races for some of the broadcasts that they did, the Arlington Million, and then, of course, the Breeders' Cup when it started, NBC had the broadcast of, and I was there for, I think, the first 5 or 6 years of the Breeders' Cup, and that was wonderful to see all the great international horses as well.
I remember that first year of the Breeders' Cup. Now, I can't remember where it was, but in Del Mar or something.
And I don't think it was Del Mar. I'm trying to think. Could it have been at Santa Anita?
Santa Anita.
Or Hollywood.
Yeah.
And it was one of the two.
And it was so exciting, and they had a whole day of racing, and you were there.
Yeah, it was great.
Well, in your book, The Best There Ever Was, Dan Patch and the Dawn of the American Century, you discuss America's obsession with racing and with boxing at the turn of the century, and kind of the birth of popular culture. And both sports have really fallen on hard times lately. What do you think has happened to horse racing? Why are champions like Seattle Slew and Secretariat and Affirmed and John Henry so hard to find nowadays?
Well, in terms of horse racing, boxing, I don't know about. In terms of horse racing, I really think it's because there's competition, both as a sporting event and in terms of gambling. There's plenty of competition in gambling now, of course. I think the creation of the state lotteries just, you know, decimated horse racing in terms of its audience that came to gamble. In terms of its sporting event, the only thing I can think of is that although it translates well to television, you can watch an exciting race on television, The story is hard to tell. You know, athletes become stars. It's hard to make a star out of a horse. That's one athlete you can't do the interviews with. The good part is they don't get into any trouble.
That's right.
But the bad part is you can't talk to them. They can't do movies. You know, the sort of things that make stars out of other athletes.
Of course, the jockeys, you can.
You can, but the jockeys, you know, they ride 7-8 races a day, every day, and so the specialness of any individual event goes away because they're the workmen of the sport. And some jockeys do become celebrated, but it's the horses that are the heroes, and they race such a short time, 2, 3, maybe 4 years, and then they're gone.
But you know a lot about horses. Why do you think there hasn't been a Triple Crown winner since Affirmed?
Because it's a very, very, very hard thing to do, and I'm glad that it is, because it should be a very special thing. I feel terrible when they start to say, well, the Belmont Stakes should be shorter, it should be further along in the summer. Of course it shouldn't be. It should be very hard to win the Triple Crown. And I would also say that although there hasn't been a winner for, gosh knows how long it's been now, 35 years, whatever it's been, some horses have come very, very, very close. So it's not impossible, and we will have one of these days. And I cheer every year for the Derby winner to become the Triple Crown winner. It hasn't happened yet, but it will.
Does it ever bother you when they, I don't even know what the sponsor is now. It's the Visa Triple Crown or something. They don't just call it the Triple Crown. Is that ever bother you?
Well, a little bit, but the sport has needed something to keep it going, so I can't be too much of a purist. I'm just happy it's still well supported.
And you're not in broadcasting anymore. Do you miss it, or?
No, I don't. I don't. I've been doing books. I've had, I think, 6 published at this point, and I really, really enjoy doing the books. I like to get into the depth of the subject, and although television was great fun, it's not a great medium for getting into depth in a subject.
Although you always did in your show. I mean, I think that was one of the trademarks of Sharon Smith.
Well, I tried to do it, and actually in the early days, ESPN was good for that, you know, for a good and bad reason. It was good for it because there weren't as many sponsors as there are now. So we did have a lot of time to fill, and they were very supportive of Down the Stretch. If I had a story idea, I could go do it. Now, we traveled very casually. I carried the television equipment just like everybody else, but they let me do the stories I wanted to do, so it was terrific.
Do you have them all the Down the Stretch episodes?
No, I don't. I have a couple. they're probably somewhere in the vaults up in Bristol. I don't know. I've never looked for one. I have a couple of tapes, but that's all.
Wow. Well, I remember it so fondly.
Oh, good.
your book, The Best There Ever Was, a biography of Dan Patch, and one thing I noticed immediately was, you know, I think the first time I hear the word Dan Patch, the first thing I think of is in The Music Man. Harold Hill makes a reference to a stuck-up jockey boy riding on Dan Patch, but that's not possible. No jockey boy ever rode on Dan.
Okay, well, he was actually ridden, apparently, a few times, but never in public, and, you know, no, there was no jockey on him.
So
but it was the name, you know, that actually kind of, that kind of represents what Dan Patch was. It was the name. A lot of people who thought the name was so important, thought he was wonderful, had no clue what he actually did.
Yeah, that he was not a thoroughbred racehorse.
He was not, no.
Well, I'll tell you what I was thinking of when I was reading your book. Several years ago, I went to the Kentucky Horse Park, and they brought Forgo, a champion horse. He came out into this little arena, and he was at liberty. He didn't have a halter or anything. And he came out, and he stood, and he looked to the little bleachers at his left, and several people snapped photographs. And then he looked to his right, and they snapped some more. And then when the cameras stopped snapping, then he turned and walked back. And it kind of, when I was reading about Dan Patch, it seemed like, you know, Dan Patch was really kind of, he had a self-awareness regarding his fame.
You know, he did. I'm sure he did. And a lot of great horses have done that, too. Of course, the most celebrated horse of very recent years was Zenyatta, the great thoroughbred mare. And she absolutely knew what she was doing. She performed for her audience. She did the little Zenyatta dance, which made people love her. She sort of pranced and threw out her feet. And although, because racing is not what it was, her fame only a little bit expanded beyond racing. It did somewhat. But I think it was part. Her personality was part of that, as was Dan Patch's. I find a lot of similarities to them. They fortunately retired her before Dan Patch, you know, earlier than Dan Patch was. He continued on far, far too long. But she was a star, and you know, it was great for racing. She made 60 Minutes twice, and when there was any doubt that she would be Horse of the Year, I actually sent out a bunch of letters saying, what are you thinking of? This horse made 60 Minutes twice. How could anybody else be Horse of the Year? I used to have a vote for Horse of the Year, and if I still did, she would have absolutely been at the top every year she raced.
And do you think the horses, for all their self-awareness, I don't think they know if they're Horse of the Year or not.
No, they don't.
But, you know, speaking of that, racehorses definitely, I think the best racehorses definitely know that they're in a race and they want to win.
Absolutely. That's, no doubt. And anybody who thinks otherwise is just plain wrong.
And is that because nature tells them to be the fastest, or why?
Well, you know, I think horses do like to run. I think that is part of their nature. They're prey animals. Running is important, and I think they, you know, they're built to run. They love it. But I think an intelligent horse will learn what they're required to do. I remember I saw John Henry race at the Meadowlands in a very long race. I'm pretty sure it was the Meadowlands, and we're talking like 30 years ago or more. And it was a race where he had to pass the finish line twice, and you know, he went under the wire once, and he was in the lead, and was confused. He thought he was supposed to pull up. It was the finish line. I was in front. What's the problem? And then he had to be urged to continue. He knew exactly where the finish line was.
That's funny.
He thought the race was a little short, but, you know, he was there.
Well, so with Dan Patch, often he ran races without any other horses.
Well, yes and no. He stopped competitive racing against other horses in an organized race when he was actually quite young. He was 6 years old. Well, he went a little bit into his seventh year because his owners felt they couldn't. They claimed they didn't have competition. Well, they could have found some, but they wanted to do time trials, which is, until recently, has been an important aspect in harness racing. They race just the 1 mile distance normally, and the fastest horse gets all the attention. So he was put into the time trials. There were not other harness racehorses racing against him. There were actually thoroughbred galloping horses racing against him to try to, you know, prompt a faster time. So yes and no, he didn't race against other horses, but there were other horses on the track.
I see. So he still had something to strive for.
Well, you know, it's pretty well established that a horse will not run as fastest unless he feels there's competition. And I think that's extra true of the great horses. It's the competition, really, that pushes them to their fastest speeds.
Do you think if there hadn't been an affirm that Aladar would have won the Triple Crown?
I think so. Aladar was a great horse.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just an absolutely outstanding horse, and, you know, he had a very brief stud career, but he proved it in the genes that he passed on. But there was a better horse that year.
Well, you don't think they needed each other? He might have just, without Affirmed, he would have just done well. There's nobody.
I think he would have done very well. He did very well in the races that Affirmed wasn't there.
Oh.
And it's possible that Affirmed needed Aladar, too, just to give him the extra impetus to keep going.
Yeah.
You never know. What if is a great game in every aspect of life, and it certainly is in horse racing as well.
We're talking with Sharon Smith, and she is the author of a new book called The Best There Ever Was, Dan Patch and the Dawn of the American Century. So I've got this book that somebody sent me that we're going to talk about on the show in a few weeks, and it's about Led Zeppelin, and its subtitle is The World's Greatest Rock and Roll Band. And I said, wait a minute. What about the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and how can, you know, come on. But you're saying Dan Patch, the best there ever was?
Well, I'm not sure, and nobody would ever be sure because he stopped racing so young and went into these controlled time trials. Now, in terms of time, you know, the speed that they got out of him in these time trials, he was up to that point. His record lasted until 1938, which, you know, over 30 years, which is amazing in a sport like harness racing. But I really chose that title because that was one of the many things that he was called in his career. I really chose it because he's an interesting figure in sporting and in horse racing history. Back in the ESPN days, when I did some coverage of harness racing, I found him interesting. The sports main awards are named for him, the Dan Patch Awards. The best horse of the year will win the Dan Patch Award. And I remember asking a few people about him, what they thought of him, experts in the sport, great drivers, and so on. And the general consensus was, well, I don't think he was all that good, but by gosh, I wish we had one like him today. So perhaps the greatness of him was the way he got so much attention and love and adoration. I mean, he was just absolutely adored during his time. And you know, that helped, certainly helped his sport then, and it would now if they could possibly get something like him.
So tell us a little bit about Dan Patch and the kind of racing he did, there was no jockey on him. He was pulling a cart or a sulky.
Yeah, he was a driving horse, and that was the biggest sport in America at the turn of the last century. There were over 1,000 racetracks. Now, that includes little fair tracks all through the Midwest and the West. California had them as well. But it was the biggest spectator sport in the country, way above thoroughbred racing, although thoroughbred racing, you know, was well established at that point. And it drew far bigger crowds than any other general kind of sporting event. So right off the top, it was the biggest sport. And he was a horse who came along out of the Midwest at a time when the Midwest was growing in national importance in harness racing and, of course, in the country. The thing that initially got the attention was his perfection. Never lost a race in the first few years of his life. He did lose a couple of heats. Harness racing was run in heats in those days, still is a little bit, where the horse would have to win 3 races in one day to actually win the race. He never lost a race, and then was turned into a time trial exhibition horse. So the perfection was the initial thing. He was a very handsome horse, which was another thing. He was surrounded by extremely colorful characters, which also got attention. And then, of course, when he was exhibited and time trialed for speed, his speeds were phenomenal. So that combination of things, plus the burgeoning press, got him on the front page of newspapers in every part of the country.
And not just newspapers, but the patent medicine.
Well, his third owner spotted him as a well-established record-breaking horse and decided, well, actually, he wasn't quite the world record holder at that point, but he had broken local records. The third owner, who was a manufacturer of patent medicines in Minneapolis, said, I'll buy myself a fancy horse, I'll make him even faster, and I can advertise this equine feed supplement as the substance that created a world champion. And he did it. And he discovered it worked. He sold bag after bag after bag of feed supplement and decided he could use his horse to sell other things. And he sold almost everything you can think of with Dan Patch's name on it.
Long after there was a Dan Patch.
Oh, well after there was a Dan Patch. I think the last contract for Dan Patch paraphernalia didn't expire till the 1950s. And since then, and I don't know if at this point they even have to pay any fees or rights to it, but there are other Dan Patch items still being sold.
We're talking with Sharon Smith, and her latest book is called The Best There Ever Was, Dan Patch and the Dawn of the American Century. They had baseball cards. I mean, it's wrong to call them baseball cards, but, I mean, a card for him also, like a trading card?
Well, you know, it wasn't so much cards as posters. Marion Savage, usually known as Will Savage, was the third owner, the patent medicine maker from Minneapolis, decided that the way to really promote it would be to offer lithographs, you know, beautiful color, well, semi-beautiful color posters of his horse, and he'd send them for free, but then he would compile a mailing list of people, and he would then send out promotion for his other materials, his feedstuffs, his various other farm implements. And so the horse and these posters were everywhere, all around farm country especially, but you can go shopping in an antique shop in Vermont, and well, of course, that's farm country, but you'll find them well out of the Midwest. These posters were just distributed everywhere. And so it was a combination of selling the name to promote other things. And then he went into putting the horse's name on the feed supplements and on the farm equipment that he sold. So it was a massive promotional merchandising industry all based around this horse.
One of the things I love about this book is that it's a wonderful, you know, sports book, and it's a great history book, and it's also a really interesting book about horse equipment and stuff. You talk about the shoeing and how the shoeing makes a huge difference in the way the horse moves, and of course you talk a lot about pacing versus trotting. Tell us a little bit about pacing. Is when the legs on either side are moving. Well, you can explain it better. You do it.
Well, it is a little bit hard to explain, but if you saw it, you would know what it is. You know, a trot, which is the standard mid-range gait of most horses, the legs on opposite sides go forward and backward at the same time. In other words, the left front and the right rear would be moving forward. The right front and the left rear would be moving back. Now, that's, you know, you see your dog trot, and that's how it would work.
Mm-hmm.
In pacing horses, the legs on the same side of the body go forward and backward at the same time. Now, dogs generally don't do this, although apparently if there are some breeds that when they get tired will do a pace, giraffes pace, for example. But it's pretty rare in the quadruped world, except in horses. And this particular tendency to pace has been lurking in the equine gene pool for thousands and thousands of years. In fact, you know, some of the cave paintings in France show horses doing what pretty much looks like a pace, and people used to think, experts used to think, that these were just not good artists, so anything you see on a horse on the wall is not accurate. Well, there's been some ancient DNA testing that's shown that in terms of the color and the spotting of the horses, well, maybe they knew what they were doing, so that would indicate that perhaps horses were pacing as far back as then. They certainly were by the time of Chaucer, because the wife of Bath was mounted on a pacer as she went on to Canterbury and telling her story. And pacers were the most common riding horse of the medieval times. So the gene has always been there. It sort of was out of the harness racing world for quite a long time, sort of on the fringes, and until in the late 19th century, people discovered that that's really a very good gait to race. It was actually faster than trotting. The horses, you know, look good as they were. Some people don't think they look good. I think they look great as they're pacing along. So it became an important gait in harness racing. And today, the figure's probably 80% of harness races are for pacers rather than trotters.
Do trotters and pacers race in the same race or never? And
almost never. I imagine there are a few, you know, fair races or something where you might see that, but basically no, because pacers are faster than trotters.
And like a flying pace, how fast is that compared to an all-out gallop that a thoroughbred horse?
Well, right now the world record for, you know, I don't know exactly what it is, for the pacing mile is probably somewhere around 146. It actually hasn't been broken for a few years, which is amazing. But say 146 for the mile, and the world record for a mile thoroughbred is somewhere around 132. So, so you can judge. The galloping is still faster, but boy, they do fly, the pacers.
And now, do they still use the hobbles that you discuss in the?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And this is a way to keep the horse from breaking into a trot when they're.
Well, you know, pacers are not going to break into a trot, but they do. You know, trotters will break into a gallop, and pacers, if they go off gate, you just can't get back onto the proper gate without slowing to a walk, and that means, you know, the race is done.
Mm-hmm.
So these hobbles, which sort of like tie the leg. Tie sounds like an extreme word. They're not tied. They're loops that sort of encourage the legs to stay in the pace. You know, it's an interesting thing because pacers and trotters are the same breed. They're standard breeds. The very fast pacers, including Dan Patch, developed because of the presence of the blood of a trotting horse. The sire and grandsire of Hamiltonian, who in the mid-19th century is the father of the entire standard bred breed, basically. He was a trotting bred horse, basically, and consequently, there's this tendency to trot remains in the most perfectly bred pacer today. So they do have to keep the hobbles. There's virtually none today that you'll see on a track that goes free legged like Dan Patch did with no hobbles.
That's a device that is strapped to their legs.
Yeah, it sort of hangs from the harness. It doesn't, like, injure the legs in any way. It doesn't restrict them. I, you know, obviously couldn't restrict them because they wouldn't go so fast. But it sort of consists of loops that keeps those two legs on the same side of the body moving forward and backward at the same time.
Now, you, I don't want to give away the ending of your book. I don't want to make anybody feel bad, but the horse does die.
Well, it's a funny thing. It does happen.
Yeah. And you did say that the horse was old for his time, and he was only 20 or 21 years old.
He was 20 when he died, which is, today, that's old enough, they say. Although I really hate to hear somebody say that a horse dies of the complications of old age and he's 22. That's terrible.
Just had a horse that lived to be 36, right?
I have a horse, or had a horse. She's been gone a couple of years now. She made 36.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how was she in her 35th year?
You know, through 35 years, she was fine. By the time she hit 36, she was, her suspensory apparatus in her legs was pretty well shot, so she had these big sort of lumps at the bottom of her ankles, and, you know, the time had come. I was very sad, but she was a wonderful horse, and did she live a long life.
So, really, the horse's biggest weakness is also their great strength, which is their legs.
Right, right.
It seems that most horses, you have the two things, the digestive system or the legs. One of those two things is going to get them.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird that they have these little tiny little ankles.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing about standardbreds is, you have to analyze the statistics, but I am convinced they say stay sound longer because they really don't have the tiny legs that thoroughbreds have. Their cannon bones are bigger. Those are the big bones between the knee and the ankle. So they don't, they don't get the same kind of cannon bone fracture that thoroughbreds get. Also, the fact that the gait has two legs pretty much on the ground at the same time probably is easier on them. They do get colic, though, as much as any other horse, which is too bad.
Yeah. Well, I want to mention also that you've got several other interesting books about horses and also about the Civil War. That's one of your other interests.
Mm-hmm.
And some of your horse books are, I guess they would be how-to or helpful books for horse owners.
Well, yeah. The very first book after I left ESPN that I wrote was The Performance Mare. I couldn't remember the name of it for a minute because it was a few years ago. That was not my choice of a name, so I think of it in terms of the first name. It was really about mares used in competition. It had been a broader topic. I even included mares used in war, war horses were female. But it ended up being just a sports book, and I thought it was a really interesting subject. It didn't sell very much. It was probably a little too specialized. And then I went into more how-to and training books. But in the Civil War, I did a book on the Civil War in Connecticut, where I live, because everybody thinks, the Civil War took place south of the Mason-Dixon line. Not true. We didn't have battles in Connecticut or any other state you can pick, but there's still a lot of places connected to that war that people can still go see.
And, of course, that was a war with a lot of horses in it.
It certainly was. It was as bad as it was on people, it was much worse on horses. 600,000 is the human casualty figure that's given. And horses, nobody really knows, at least 2 million, probably 3 million horses were killed. And you can make an argument that the North won the war for many reasons, but one is they had a much greater supply of horses. The southern horses were killed off very quickly, and of course horses don't mature very quickly, so if you lose all your horses in 1 year, you're not going to have the rest, have new ones ready to go 3 years later. It just doesn't work that way. So it was a bad war for horses.
Do you think losing such a large number of horses affected the breeds?
Well, I don't know. On the other hand, it did it helped the I shouldn't say create the Morgan breed, for example, but it certainly brought the Morgan breed to the attention of a good amount of the country that hadn't really been aware of this, very tough, very sturdy, but light and agile animal. And so it was important in that sense. Horse racing did very well for a number of years after the war. So, as I said, the North had a lot of horses, so racing in the South virtually disappeared after the Civil War. There, it had been a pretty big area for racing, especially in New Orleans and some other places, and it disappeared in the South for many years, as did many other industries.
This book is called The Best There Ever Was, Dan Patch and the Dawn of the American Century. The author is Sharon B. Smith. Sharon Smith, will you come back and talk horses some more with us sometime soon?
I would love to. I love to talk horses, as you can tell.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I want to thank my guest, Sharon B. Smith. Her latest book is called The Best There Ever Was, Dan Patch and the Dawn of the American Century. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. And I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.